The Ninth and Main Church of Christ in San Angelo, Texas. I invite you to be turning with me this morning to Exodus chapter 26. Exodus chapter 26 is where we will be studying from this morning. We'll be talking about the construction of the tabernacle as we study together this morning. In our book, Today is Mine, by Brother Brownlow, today is August 24th, entitled School of Affliction. He says, affliction is the school that lasts a lifetime. No one ever graduates until he steps all the way across the stage into the next world. Every person is a student. The courses vary with individuals, but each has his own load. Painful and trying, no school does more for us if we are apt learners. In every hurt, there can be a lesson that develops character, increases sympathy, adds to patience, fortifies for disappointment, firms willpower, lifts the eyes to see the more valuable values, and multiplies wisdom by prodding one to think deeper. Now this personal question, what about your grades? Henry Wadsworth Longfellow wrote, now how sublime a thing it is to suffer and be strong. And of course, Paul wrote to the Corinthians in 2 Corinthians 4 and verse 17, for our light affliction, which is but for a moment, worketh for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. And it was James who wrote, let us count it all joy when we fall into diverse temptations. Friends, we as Christians, we're going to suffer affliction. As we go through this life, there are going to be things that befall us, friends, that seem rather harsh, that seem maybe that we are not going to be able to handle them at the time. But friends, we can overcome. With our hope in Jesus Christ, with the salvation that God has promised, so long as we are obedient unto him, we can overcome whatever we are afflicted with in this life, no doubt. And maybe we can learn something from the affliction that is brought our way. Now, in Exodus chapter 26, as we are continuing our study of the scheme of redemption, we're looking bit by bit and looking at this picture that God is unfolding for us. And now we've come to the tabernacle. And remember that as we study a good bit of these things, that we're looking at some types and shadows, some types and antitypes, and the tabernacle is no different. We looked last week at many of those types and antitypes. And so now let's look at the construction itself as God continues to reveal his will, to reveal himself unto us in unfolding this scheme of redemption. Now we have to keep in mind that as we study this construction of the tabernacle, that the God of heaven does not dwell on earth, not even in the most elaborate of mansions. The tabernacle is said to be God's dwelling place, but friend, it's only in a representative manner. Acts 17 and verse 24 says, God that made the world and all things therein, seeing that he is Lord of heaven and earth, dwelleth not in temples made with hands. In 1 Kings 8 and verse 27 we read, but will God indeed dwell on the earth? Behold, the heaven and heaven of heavens cannot contain thee, how much less this house that I have builded. You see, this verse has reference to the magnificent temple that Solomon had built, and it shows us that God indeed does not dwell in something made with man's hands. Now, the instructions given in this particular chapter, in Exodus chapter 26, coupled with the vision that Moses had been given on the mount and the Israelites' knowledge and skills of tent building, they were sufficient for them to construct the tabernacle just like God wanted. Now, friends, since we don't have the same skills, and since we did not see the picture, of what Moses saw, that God gave Moses, that the instructions contained in this chapter are likely insufficient for us to reconstruct it precisely today. Now, what is given here was supplemental to the pattern shown to Moses on the mount. Excuse me one moment. Now, the Israelites had men who were gifted with expertise in working with wood and metal as well, to produce the intricate designs required by God's divine plan. Now, Kaufman points this out. He says, one cannot fail to be disappointed by many of the commentaries on this particular chapter, which are preoccupied with problems arising from the incomplete nature of the instructions. Now, one thing is sure. No one today following these instructions could go out and construct anything like what Moses built, that not at all being the purpose of these instructions. That the instructions are indeed incomplete is evident. We do not know if it had a flat roof or a sloping roof like tents have today. Now, some have envisioned the tabernacle as having a flat roof, others with one or three ridge poles. Now, it's been pictured at different heights as well. And there are no two commentators anywhere who agree on what was meant by the doubling of the boards, verse 24. The very meaning of the Hebrew term here rendered doubled is not fully known. Noth thought that the bars went on the outside, while others believed they went inside. Furthermore, regarding the pillars, did they go inside the fine linen curtains decorated with the cherubim, or on the outside, in which case the gold-covered pillars would have been completely hidden? Other examples of this incompleteness could be cited as well, but these are sufficient for us here to show that God was not telling all future generations how to make that tabernacle, but rather it was to Moses only. The things that were mentioned in these verses were given for the purpose not of enabling us to build a tabernacle, but for the purpose of giving facts about it that are pertinent and significant for all generations because they are copies of the things in heaven. Again, this idea of the types and antitypes are coming into play. Now, let's get to the chapter itself, Exodus 26. Exodus 26, 1 through 6. Here in this passage, we have instruction on the curtains. And thou shalt make an altar of kittim wood, 5 cubits long, 5 cubits broad. The altar shall be 4 square, beginning there in verse 1, and the height thereof shall be 3 cubits. And thou shalt make the horns of it upon the 4 corners thereof. His horns shall be of the same. And thou shalt overlay it with brass, and thou shalt make his pans to receive his ashes, and his shovels, and his basins, and his flesh hooks, and his fire pans, all the vessels thereof thou shalt make of brass. All right, so the curtains were to be 28 cubits long. That is, they were to be approximately 42 feet. Each was to be 4 cubits in width, or approximately 6 feet. Now, there were to be 10 curtains in all, and all were to be the same size. They were to be made of linen in 3 rich colors. They were to be blue, purple, and scarlet. And these are said to have been the most expensive dyes of ancient times. Cherubims of cunning work, as the Bible points out, were to be embroidered upon these linen curtains, making a very beautiful, expensive, and appropriate inner lining. 5 curtains were to be coupled together, giving 2 sections of curtains, each measuring 42 feet in length and 30 feet in width. Possibly these 2 sections were attached to the inside of the framework of the tabernacle, running from end to end, with 1 section covering from the center of the structure to the bottom of the side, and the other doing the same on the opposite half of the tent. It would be draped down at each end of the tabernacle, but perhaps they ran from side to side as the next covering. But verses 4 through 6 read, and thou shalt make the loops of blue upon the edge of the one curtain from the selvage in the coupling, and likewise shalt thou make in the uttermost edge of another curtain in the coupling of the second. 50 loops shalt thou make in the one curtain, and 50 loops shalt thou make in the edge of the curtain that is in the coupling of the second, that the loops may take hold one of another. And thou shalt make 50 taches of gold, and couple the curtain together with the taches, and it shall be one tabernacle. Okay, so 50 loops of blue made for each of the 2 sections so that they could be joined perhaps at the center top, the selvage, meaning end or extremity. The 50 taches or clasps of gold will be made as the means of connecting these 2 sections of curtains. And now you have the instructions for the outer coverings beginning in verse 7. Okay, now again, as God is giving these things, notice how specific the instructions are. Okay, why not just tell Moses to make loops? Why tell him how many? Why tell him that they were to be blue. Okay, God is being very specific in how Moses is to build these things, how these things are to be made. Friends, let that be a lesson to us that as we study our Bibles and God is specific in how we are to worship, that he means what he says. God didn't tell Moses not to use red. He didn't tell Moses not to use black. He didn't tell Moses not to use any other color, but rather he told him what color they were to be, 50 loops of blue. Okay, so we understand that God, in being specific concerning these things, it excludes everything else. Verse 7 begins, "And thou shalt make curtains of goat's hair." Okay, not any other kind, but goat's hair. "To be a covering upon the tabernacle, 11 curtains shalt thou make. The length of one curtain shall be 30 cubits, and the breadth of one curtain 4 cubits. And the 11 curtains shall be all of one measure. And thou shalt couple 5 curtains by themselves, 6 curtains by themselves, and shalt double the 6th curtain in the forefront of the tabernacle." Again, specificity here. Goat's hair. There were to be 11 of this material, each of the same length. 5 connected together to form one section. 5, or the remaining 6, rather, were to be connected on as a second section. The 6th curtain was to be made double, that is, folded together towards the front of the tent so as to form a kind of gable, as Josephus has also explained this particular passage in his Antiquities. Now, verse 10 through 13. We read, "And thou shalt make 50 loops on the edge of the one curtain that is outmost in the coupling, and 50 loops in the edge of the curtain which coupleth the second." Again, the specificity here. "And thou shalt make 50 tashes of brass, and put the tashes in the loops, and couple the tent together, that it may be one. And the remnant that remaineth of the curtains of the tent, the half curtain that remaineth, shall hang over the back side of the tabernacle, and a cubit on the one side, and a cubit on the other side of that which remaineth in the length of the curtains of the tent. It shall hang over the sides of the tabernacle on this side and on that side to cover it." Again, God being very, very specific, 50 loops be made on the edges of each of the curtain sections. Tashes or clasps of brass were to be made for each of these loops that the two sections could be connected together again. Okay, so now this tenth cloth was 2 cubits longer than the inner one, as each piece was 30 cubits long instead of 28. All right, it was also 2 cubits broader, as it was composed of 11 pieces. The 11th only reckoned as 2 cubits, as it was to be laid double. Now, on the back side of the tabernacle, the extra 1/2 cubit was to be placed, and the extra 2 cubits in length were to be put 1 cubit on each side. Verse 14 states, "And thou shalt make a covering for the tent of ram skins." Okay, you had goat's hair, but now ram skins, dyed red, and a covering above of badger skins. 2 additional coverings. Now remember last week we talked about badgers. Most likely it is rather here seal skins. Okay. Now, 2 additional coverings, as we see here in verse 14, were to be made. One of rams dyed red, the other of badger skins. Now apparently, seal skins, apparently these coverings were to the outer layers which were exposed to the elements. The effect of these 4 coverings that was the outside, that the outside light would be shut out, and the wind and the dust could be excluded as well as the rain. Now, since the tabernacle was to be used for a period of time after entering Canaan, the materials were durable. And since there are rainy seasons in the land, the roof was possibly sloped to some degree, since a flat roof of the materials used would collect water and sag inwardly. Okay, so that is, unless the boards that we're about to describe were to be on top. So, again, keep in mind that these instructions are a bit incomplete because we don't have access to the vision that Moses was given here. Beginning of verse 15, we read, "And thou shalt make boards for the tabernacle of kittim wood standing up. 10 cubits shall be the length of a board, and a cubit and a half shall be the breadth of one board. 2 tenons shall there be in one board, set in order one against another. Thus shalt thou make for all the boards of the tabernacle. And thou shalt make the boards for the tabernacle, 20 boards on the south side, southward. And thou shalt make 40 sockets of silver under the 20 boards. 2 sockets under one board for his 2 tenons, 2 sockets under another board for his 2 tenons. And for the second side of the tabernacle on the north side, there shall be 20 boards. And there 40 sockets of silver, 2 sockets under one board, 2 sockets under another board." Specificity. Okay, that's what we're seeing throughout this entire process. God is being very, very specific on how these things are to be made. He's given definite numbers. He's given definite materials. I mean, there's no way around this pattern that God is delivering to his people. God, in revealing his scheme of redemption, is telling them that he has a very specific plan in mind, and it is to be followed to the letter. Verses 22 to 25. For the sides of the tabernacle westward, thou shalt make 6 boards, and 2 boards shalt thou make for the corners of the tabernacle and the 2 sides, and they shall be coupled together beneath, and they shall be coupled together above the head of it into 1 ring. Thus shall it be for them both. They shall be for the 2 corners, and they shall be 8 boards, and their sockets of silver, 16 sockets, 2 sockets under 1 board, and 2 sockets under another board. The western end, as we just read, 6 boards of the same width and height as the other boards, plus 2 boards were to be placed at the corners. They were to be coupled together. Okay, the meaning of these words, which are very obscure in some points, can only be the following. The 2 corner beams at the back were to consist of 2 pieces joined together at a right angle so as to form as double boards 1 single hole from the bottom to the top. God very specific in his plan. Now, in verses 26 through 30, you have the instructions on the making of the bars. And thou shalt make bars of kittim wood. 5 for the boards of the one side of the tabernacle, and 5 bars for the boards of the other side of the tabernacle, and 5 bars for the boards of the side of the tabernacle for the 2 sides westward. And the middle bar in the midst of the board shall reach from end to end. And thou shalt overlay the boards with gold, and make their rings of gold for places for the bars, and thou shalt overlay the bars with gold. All right. 5 bars of acacia wood, kittim wood, were to be fashioned for each of the 3 sides, south, west, and north. These bars, it seems, were to be placed horizontally. The middle of these bars was to extend the full length of the structure. And the description is really, it's kind of difficult for us to grasp. Golden rings are mentioned, so it may be that some of the bars pass through these rings. Keel suggests this. He says that the other 4 bars on every side were not to reach the whole length of the walls. And we may therefore suppose that they were only half as long as the middle one, so that there were only 3 rows of bars on each wall, the upper and lower being composed of 2 bars each. The boards and bars were overlaid with gold, as we read. Now, verse 30 says, "And thou shalt rear up the tabernacle according to the fashion thereof, which was showed thee in the mount." Okay, so here again, it is alluded back to the vision given to Moses. Okay. Again and again and again, the warning is issued that the tabernacle was to be reared up according to the fashion, according to the pattern shown Moses on the mount. The Hebrews writer writes in Hebrews 8 and verse 5, "Who serve unto the example and shadow of heavenly things, as Moses was admonished of God when he was about to make the tabernacle. For see, saith he, that thou make all things according to the pattern showed to thee in the mount." This scheme of redemption that God is unfolding for us, friends, follows a definite pattern, one that can be followed. In chapter 26, 31 through 37, you see the veil and the placement of the particular furnishings. Verse 31. We read, "And thou shalt make a veil of blue and purple and scarlet, and fine twined linen of cunning work, that is skilled work, with cherubim shall it be made. And thou shalt hang it upon 4 pillars of kittim wood overlaid with gold. Their hook shall be of gold upon the 4 sockets of silver." Okay, this veil was to divide the tabernacle into 2 separate rooms. It was to be made of linen of blue, purple, and scarlet colors. The material, the color, and design were all identical with the interior lining. 4 pillars of acacia wood, kittim wood, overlaid with gold, were to be erected as the means of hanging the veil. The hooks upon which the silver sockets were placed were to be of gold. Verses 33 to 35, we read, "And thou shalt hang up the veil under the tashes, that thou mayest bring in thither within the veil the ark of the testimony, and the veil shall divide unto you between the holy place and the most holy. And thou shalt put the mercy seat upon the ark of the testimony in the most holy place, and thou shalt set the table without the veil. and the candlestick over against the table on the side of the tabernacle toward the south. Thou shalt put the table on the north side. Now the Ark of the Testimony, that is the Ark of the Covenant, was to be placed in the most holy place behind or to the west of the veil. The candlestick was to be placed opposite the table of showbread on the south side of the holy place. Thus the table of showbread was on the north side. The altar of incense is not mentioned here, but Exodus 30, verses 1 through 9, places it before the veil. In verses 36 and 37, we read, "And thou shalt make an hanging for the door of the tent, of blue and purple and scarlet, and fine twined linen, wrought with needlework. And thou shalt make for the hanging five pillars of kittim wood, and overlay them with gold, and their hooks shall be of gold, and thou shalt cast five sockets of brass for them." So the closure for the east is here described, and it included more of the fine linen, beautifully dyed. There are also five pillars of acacia wood overlaid with gold, with golden hooks to receive the brass sockets. And so we have now the door of the tabernacle. Friends, I cannot stress enough the specificity with which God instructed Moses and the Israelites to build the tabernacle. He gave them a definite pattern, a definite plan that they were to follow. And friends, we know that God means what he says. If those instructions were not followed, then God would not have been pleased. After these instructions for the tabernacle, beginning in chapter 27, you see God giving instructions beginning in this chapter for constructing the altar. In verses 1 and 2, we read, "And thou shalt make an altar of kittim wood, 5 cubits long and 5 cubits broad. The altar shall be 4 square, and the height thereof shall be 3 cubits. And thou shalt make the horns of it, the horns of it upon the 4 corners thereof. His horns shall be of the same, and thou shalt overlay it with brass." Again, specific instructions, 5 cubits long, 5 cubits wide, 3 cubits high. The measurements will make it about 7.5 feet in length and width, and about 4.5 feet high. Now, this assumes 18 inches per cubit. Okay, now let me remind you what a cubit is, okay? It's not necessarily just a strict standard of measurement, but it is from, if you'll take your hand, I can show you what a cubit is right now, and just hold your arm your elbow at a 90-degree angle for an adult now. A cubit would be from the elbow to the tip of the middle finger. Okay, that's a cubit. And on average, it's about 18 inches. Okay, so we're talking about, about 7.5 feet in length, 4.5 feet wide, assuming 18 inches per cubit. Now, it was to be made of acacia wood, overlaid with brass, and as things are translated, or as the word here is translated brass, it could be bronze, it could be copper. Now, horns, again, were to be made on the corners. These horns would serve several possible purposes as ornamental adornments that could have been used to tie the victims to the altar to prevent their falling off the altar. Psalm 118 and verse 27, the horns are mentioned. God is the Lord, which has showed us light, bind. These horns may have been used for binding the sacrifice, as the psalmist writes, with cords, even into the horns of the altar. Continuing with the altar, verse 3, we read, "And thou shalt make his pans," the altar's pans, "to receive his ashes, his shovels, and his basins, and his flesh hooks, and his fire pans, all the vessels thereof thou shalt make of brass." Now, the utensils, you see, as we read there at the end of the verse, were to be made of brass. Gold and silver would not be near as durable as brass in the heavy work of offering animal sacrifices. Those are softer metals. Okay, pans and shovels would be needed in taking away the ashes. Basins would be required in catching the blood of the victims. Flesh hooks would be needed in moving the victim. Fire pans were likely to hold the fire. Now, some scholars suggest that the fire which fell upon the altar from heaven, Leviticus 9 and verse 24, was retained in the fire pans. And after the camp moved, or when the altar was being cleaned, the fire was replenished from the fire kept alive in the fire pans. Blood was smeared on the horns, Leviticus 4 and verse 7, and those who fled to the altar to save their lives laid hold on the horns, Exodus 21 and verse 14, 1 Kings 1, 50 to 53. Now, verses 4 and 5, we read, "And thou shalt make for it a grated network of brass, and upon the net shalt thou make 4 brazen rings in the 4 corners thereof, and thou shalt put it under the compass of the altar beneath, that the net may be even to the midst of the altar. A grate, okay, a net. A grate was to be made. It was to be constructed. Keel thought that this was a narrow walkway placed on the sides of the altar and extended completely around it. The priest could then stand on it while performing the various activities pertaining to the sacrifice. Others think that it was a grating upon which the victim was laid while being offered. In this case, the wood would be underneath the grating. And then there are others that think that the grating was built into the sides of the altar to allow air to be drawn for the fire. Now, the most natural view seems to be that this was a grating upon which the victim was laid and underneath of which the fire was built. And this suggested that's suggested as well by the wording of verse 5. Four brazen rings were to be put on the four corners of the altar for the purpose of carrying it from place to place, it seems. Verses 6 through 8, we read, "And thou shalt make staves for the altar, staves of kittim wood, and overlay them with brass. And the staves shall be put into the rings, and the staves shall be upon the two sides of the altar to bear it. Hollow with boards shalt thou make it, as it was showed thee in the mount, so they shall make it again." Again, reference made to the vision given to Moses on the mount. We don't have access to all of that. And so these instructions, specific as they are not complete for us. We could never totally and completely and accurately reconstruct the tabernacle. We can get the measurements for the most part right. We have the idea of the two rooms and such, but we're not going to have everything positioned just right and all of this, because God keeps referring to this vision that is not recorded for us. Okay, and so there's another lesson in that as well, isn't it? That God records what we need to know. God, in recording these things, and in recording the construction of the tabernacle and all the instructions for it, the specific instructions concerning all these things, God lets us know that he has a specific plan and that he expects it to be carried out. And again, referring Moses back to the vision that he had seen, he reminds him that you do it exactly how I showed you it ought to be done. Beginning in verse 9 now. We have the instructions for the constructing the outer enclosure of the court. "And thou shalt make the court of the tabernacle. Okay, for the south side southward there shall be hangings for the court of fine twine linen, of 100 cubits long from one side, and the 20 pillars thereof, and their 20 sockets shall be of brass. The hooks of the pillars and their fillets shall be of silver. And likewise for the north side of the length there shall be hangings of 100 cubits long, and his 20 pillars and their 20 sockets of brass, the hooks of the pillars and their fillets of silver. And for the breadth of the court on the west side shall be hangings of 50 cubits, their pillars 10, and their sockets 10, and the breadth of the court and the cast, or the east side, on the east side, eastward, shall be 50 cubits. The hangings of the one side of the gate shall be 15 cubits, the pillars 3, and their sockets 3. And on the other side shall be hangings 15 cubits, their pillars 3, and their sockets 3. The north and west sides of this enclosure were to be 50, or were to be 100 cubits in length, or about 150 feet, we see. They were to be made of fine twine linen with the necessary pillars, sockets, hooks, and fillets, or fasteners. Okay, the end of the court, west and east ends of the enclosure were to be 50 cubits, or around 75 feet. These were each to have 10 pillars and sockets. All right. Verse 18 indicates that the height of these outer walls was to be 5 cubits, or 7.5 feet. It was to be about one half as tall as the tabernacle, and thus did not hide the tabernacle from the view of those outside the court. In verses 16 through 19, we read, "And for the gate of the court shall be an hanging of 20 cubits of blue and purple and scarlet and fine twined linen wrought with needlework, and their pillars shall be 4 and their sockets 4. All the pillars round about the court shall be filleted with silver. Their hooks shall be of silver and their sockets of brass. The length of the court shall be 100 cubits, the breadth 50 everywhere, and the height 5 cubits of fine twined linen and their sockets of brass. All the vessels of the tabernacle and all the service thereof and all the pens thereof and all the pens of the court shall be of brass." All right, so we're given the dimensions of the gate, 20 cubits in length, made of blue, purple, and scarlet, fine twine linen. Proper pillars, fillets, hooks, sockets were all to be made. And verse 18 stresses the dimensions of the outer court. While the next verse says that the vessels of the tabernacle, here evidently referring to those tools needed to dismantle and erect the structure, were to be made of brass. Verses 20 and 21, you have instruction regarding the lighting of the tabernacle. Verse 20, and thou shalt command the children of Israel that they bring the pure oil olive, beaten for the light, to cause the lamp to burn always. Okay, so Israel is to prepare pure, beaten olive oil for the candlestick or the lampstand. This is said to be oil produced from olives which were bruised, not crushed. Okay. Normally, olives were crushed in order to remove the oil, but in this case, the oil was to be obtained by gentler methods, thus producing finer, cleaner oil. In verse 21, in the tabernacle of the congregation without the veil, which is before the testimony, Aaron and his son shall order it from evening to morning before the Lord, and it shall be a statute forever unto their generations on the behalf of the children of Israel. Okay, so those appointed priests were to service the candlestick. Now, some think it was burning only at night. Others say it burned continually. Exodus 30, verse 8 says, and when Aaron lighteth the lamps at even, he shall burn incense upon it, a perpetual incense before the Lord throughout your generations. 1 Samuel 3, and verse 3, and ere the lamp of God went out in the temple of the Lord, where the ark of God was, and Samuel was laid down to sleep. Okay, so it would seem that the lamps would be extinguished while being refilled and cleaned. It's unclear whether they burned only at night or constantly, but they were to be used throughout the Mosaic Age, hence the use of the word perpetual in Exodus 30 and verse 8. Now let's start in verse 28. Here we're going to get to the priesthood. Now remember, nothing's changed, okay? We're talking about the scheme of redemption. Although we're going through a verse-by-verse study of Exodus, it's all about the scheme of redemption, God revealing his plan to us. And he's doing it in such a way that we're now, in light of the New Testament, we're able to understand what these things mean, what he's talking about, the types and the antitypes that are given. The garments for the priest, friends, are no different. Okay, the physical garments for the priest, in a manner of speaking, represent our spiritual garments. This is how we are to be spiritually adorned before God. Okay, so we are to keep ourselves pure. We are purified before the Lord in the washing of His blood through the watery grave of baptism. And so, as we study these things, just keep that in mind. Right? In chapter 28, beginning here in verses 1 through 5, talks about the making of garments for Aaron himself, the high priest. All right, this paragraph at the beginning here, it introduces a dramatic change into the religious economy of Israel. Now, until this particular point, Moses himself had acted in the capacity of a high priest, actually sprinkling the blood upon the people in the ratification of the covenant. Go back to chapter 24 and verse 8 and you see that. There had never been an established priesthood dedicated to the worship of Jehovah prior to the one commanded here. Okay, in the patriarchal age, it was the head of the household. Job offered sacrifices for his family, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, as well as countless others, as the firstborn or heads of families had discharged the duties of priest. Now, the entire period of history was called the patriarchal age, but now, with the setting up of the Aaronic priesthood, the Mosaic dispensation would begin, meaning the age which in matters of the priesthood would follow the instructions God gave to Moses here. Verse 1, chapter 28, we read, and take thou unto thee Aaron thy brother, and his sons with him from among the children of Israel, that he may minister unto me in the priest's office, even Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar, Aaron's sons. God gives instruction to Moses here. You take Aaron, you take his four sons, Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, Ithamar. You set aside these men as the first priests. Now, as it turns out, Aaron is the high priest, the first in a long line of high priests, extending down to the end of the Jewish system. Now, some have wondered why Aaron was chosen for this high office instead of Moses. Now, the reasons offered are perhaps many, but the chief one seems to be that Christ was to be a high priest after the order of Melchizedek, not after the Aaronic priesthood. Now, Aaron was imperfect in life. He was involved in the golden calf episode, Exodus chapter 32. We're getting there, and there's a lot of stuff there in chapter 32. And he joined Miriam in trying to usurp the authority of Moses in Numbers chapter 12. Now, Moses as a lawgiver was a type of Christ. Nadab and Abihu were slain by God when they offered strange fire in their worship unto God, Leviticus chapter 10. Eleazar then followed Aaron as high priest, Numbers 3 and verse 4. Later, the descendants of Ithamar became high priests from Eli through Abiathar, 1 Samuel 2, 27 and following, 1 Kings 2 and beginning of verse 26. And then you have 1 Chronicles 6, beginning of verse 18, and that shows that the descendants of Eleazar served in this capacity from Zadok on in 1 Chronicles chapter 24. Now, in verses 2 and 3, we read, "And thou shalt make holy garments for Aaron thy brother, for glory and for beauty. And thou shalt speak unto all that are wise-hearted, whom I have filled with the spirit of wisdom, that they may make Aaron's garments to consecrate him, that he may minister unto me in the priest's office." Here God begins the instructions concerning Aaron's priestly garments. They are to serve the purpose of presenting glory and beauty. The Lord even refers to them as holy garments. These garments would be impressive in their design, in their beauty, in their glory. They would give Israel something more to appreciate and respect. Now, these garments were to be worn when Aaron was discharging his priestly functions. It would impress upon him and the people the need for holiness and preparedness in approaching the Almighty God. The richness of the privilege of serving God would also be impressed upon their minds. In verse 3, we see that there were certain men who had been given special skills which were to be utilized in making these particular garments. God is able to raise up, friends, certain people who have the inborn talents to do things needed for the time. Consider Samson. For all his faults, he was what was needed at the time. Saul, David, Solomon, Paul. The garments were to consist of a breastplate, an ephod, a robe, a broidered coat, a mitre, and a girdle. Okay, the instructions are to follow regarding the making of appropriate garments for the lesser priest, starting with Aaron's sons. Okay, the verses 4 and 5 give the specific garments to be made. The ones we just listed, a breastplate, an ephod, a robe, a broidered coat. Verse 4, a mitre and a girdle. Verse 5, "And they shall make holy garments for Aaron and thy brother and his sons, that he may minister unto me in the priest's office, and they shall take gold and blue and purple and scarlet and fine linen." Okay, the design of the garments would allow them to be used by a variety of different men of varying sizes over many years. Okay, as it appears in later descriptions, there were two pieces to the ephod, which could be adjusted to fit different sizes. Gold was used. Costly and beautiful dyes were used. Fine linen. They were all to be used in the making of these garments. Now, listen to the instructions for the making of the ephod. Again, let us stress the specificity that God uses here. Down to the minutest details, okay? Beginning there in verse 6, "And they shall make the ephod of gold, of blue, and of purple, of scarlet, and fine twined linen with cunning work," skilled work, cunning. "It shall have the two shoulder pieces thereof joined at the two edges thereof, and so it shall be joined together. And the curious girdle of the ephod, which is upon it, shall be of the same, according to the work thereof, even of gold, of blue, and purple, and scarlet, and fine twined linen. And thou shalt take two onyx stones, engrave on them the names of the children of Israel, six of their names on one stone, and the other six names of the rest on the other stone, according to their birth, with the work of an engraver in stone, like the engravings of a signet. Shalt thou engrave the two stones, which the names of the children of Israel. Thou shalt make them to be set in ounces of gold. And thou shalt put the names of the children of Israel, thou shalt make them be sent out, and thou shalt put the two stones upon the shoulders of the ephod for stones of memorial unto the children of Israel, and Aaron shall bear their names before the Lord upon his two shoulders for a memorial." All right, here's a principal element in the high priest outfit, okay? Bearing not only the memorial stones on the shoulders, but also the breastplate, which will be described next, with its four rows of memorial stones. The mention of the two ends indicates that it was long enough to come down to about the knees, both front and back, connected with straps to which there were affixed the onyx stone memorials at the shoulder level. The arrangement permitted the adjustment of the straps to fit any sized person. All right, the two onyx stones were to be set on the shoulders of the ephod, Upon each of these two stones were to be engraved the names of six sons of Israel according to their birth. Now, this could mean according to the chronological or order of the birth of Jacob's sons, or by some division of the sons according to their mothers. To Leah were born Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. To Rachel, Joseph, and Benjamin. To Leah's handmaid Zilpah were born Gad and Asher. To Rachel's handmaid Bilhah were Dan and Naphtali. All right, since Leah had six sons herself, perhaps they were listed on one stone, and the sons of the other three women were listed on the other stone. Now, how they were divided really is not important for us to know. But the precise work of the engravers is to be greatly admired. The engravings would be on the order of a signet ring. The KJV has ouches where, as the ASV describes the place where these stones were placed as settings of gold. The stones were to be served, were to serve as memorials. Since God did not need to be reminded of the names of Jacob's sons, the memorial was intended for others. It would be a notice to Israel that the high priest was acting on their behalf, and a reminder to the high priest himself of the nature of his work in the behalf of the whole nation. Now, many men want to have a special priesthood after the fashion of the Aaronic priests. But friend, the Lord made use of these priests to perform a service in that long ago age. He never intended for this to be in use in his church today. Every Christian is a priest. 1 Peter 2:5-9. And as such, they can approach God directly through Jesus Christ. To set up a separate priesthood, as the Catholics and others have done, is to revert back to the Old Testament way, and it is to miss the blessings of Jesus Christ. Galatians 5:4, Galatians 3:10, 2 Corinthians chapter 3. The entire book of Hebrews drives that point home. Hebrews 7:18-22, more specifically. The New Testament is built upon a better covenant with a better system in every way. Again, Hebrews 7. A man is foolish indeed to hold on to the shadow when he can have the substance. Verses 13-14. We read, "And thou shalt make ouches or settings of gold, and two chains of pure gold at the ends of the wreathen work shalt thou make them, and fasten the wreathen chains to the ouches or the settings." All right, those should have been made of gold. Specific here, God again, being very specific. Two chains of pure gold were to be made to be fastened to the settings. Now, the New King James reads this way. He says, "You shall also make settings of gold, and you shall make two chains of pure gold like braided cords, and fasten the braided chains to the settings." All right, so friend, this ephod was a garment. But the same word is later used in reference to some kind of image. Look at Judges 8:24-37. The Hebrew language had to make more than one use for many of its words. And so we do the same in English today, but to a much lesser degree. Next is the breastplate, verses 15-30. "And thou shalt make the breastplate of judgment with cunning work," again, skilled work. This wasn't just something that was to be done haphazardly. "After the work of the ephod, thou shalt make it of gold, of blue, and of purple, of scarlet and of fine twined linen shalt thou make it, four square. It shall be being doubled. A span shall be the length thereof. A span shall be the breadth thereof. And thou shalt set in its settings of stones, even four rows of stones. The first row shall be a sardius, a topaz, and a carbuncle. This shall be the first row. And the second row shall be an emerald, a sapphire, and a diamond. And the third row a ligure, an agate, and an amethyst. And the fourth row a beryl, and an onyx, and a jasper. They shall be set in gold in their enclosings. And the stones shall be with the names of the children of Israel, 12 according to their names, like the engravings of a signet. Every one with his name shall they be according to the 12 tribes." And friends, the current use of the word breastplate is to describe a part of a suit of armor which protects the chest. And this garment of the high priest's clothing is spoken of as a breastplate because it covered this particular area of the body, not because it was intended as protection. It is called the breastplate of judgment. Don't miss that. Now, as we'll get to later, the breastplate had a pocket in which the Urim and Thummim were kept. The breastplate is likely called the breastplate of judgment because various judgment or rulings were received by means of the Urim and Thummim. Okay, it was to be made of gold, blue, purple, scarlet, and fine twined linen. All right, again, beauty and richness of the ephod characterized this particular item as well. This breastplate, on it there were to be placed four rows of three stones. On these stones, the names of the children of Israel were to be engraved, as on the two stones discussed earlier. Okay, you compare this description with that given in Revelation 21. The heavenly city and the breastplate are four square. Each has 12 names recorded, the children of Israel, the apostles. Okay? Now, let's lay this out here. Okay, the 12 stones. On the first row, you had sardius or ruby, topaz, carbuncle. Okay, the ruby would represent Reuben, topaz, Simeon, and carbuncle, Levi. All right, all sons of Leah. The second row, you have the emerald, the sapphire, and diamond. All right, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun. Again, all sons of Leah. On the third row, you have Ligura or Jacinth, Dan, Agate, Naphtali, Amethyst, Gad. And then the fourth row, Beryl or Chrysolite is Asher. Onyx or Sardonyx is Joseph. And Jasper would be Benjamin. Verses 22 to 30. Read, and thou shalt make upon the breastplate chains at the ends of wreathen work of pure gold, and thou shalt make upon the breastplate two rings of gold, and thou shalt put the two rings on the two ends of the breastplate. And thou shalt put on the two wreathen chains of gold and the two rings which are on the ends of the breastplate, and the other two ends of the two wreathen chains. Thou shalt fasten in the two ouches or settings and put them on the shoulder pieces of the ephod before it. And thou shalt make two rings of gold, and thou shalt put them upon the two ends of the breastplate and the border thereof, which is in the side of the ephod inward. The two other rings of gold thou shalt make, and shall put them on the two sides of the ephod underneath, toward the forepart thereof, over against the other coupling thereof, above the curious girdle of the ephod. And they shall bind the breastplate by the rings thereof unto the rings of the ephod with the lace of blue, that it may be above the curious girdle of the ephod, that the breastplate be not loosed from the ephod. And Aaron shall bear the names of the children of Israel in the breastplate of judgment upon his heart, when he goeth in into the holy place for a memorial before the Lord continually. And thou shalt put in the breastplate of judgment the Urim and the Thummim. And they shall be upon Aaron's heart when he goeth in before the Lord. And Aaron shall bear the judgment of the children of Israel upon his heart before the Lord continually. All right, here descriptions are given. Two rings of gold, to which the two wreathen chains of gold were to be passed. These chains were fastened to the settings described earlier. Now, two other chains of gold were to be made and were to be connected to the breastplate in some way unclear to us to bind the breastplate to the lower end of the garment. Now, there's been much speculation, but really little information that has resulted from considering these items. In some way, undiscovered by modern man, the Urim and Thummim were able to give to Israel some judgments of God. Now, what the Urim and Thummim really were cannot be determined with certainty, either from the names themselves or from any other circumstances connected with them. If the Urim and Thummim had been intended to represent any really existing thing, their nature or the mode of preparing them would certainly have been described. Now, Kaufman says this. He says, we do not know what these were. They appear to have been two objects already widely known and apparently having been used to determine in some manner God's will regarding certain questions that could have been answered by some system of inquiry suggesting, to some at least, the casting of lots or dice. Now, the function of the Urim and Thummim illustrated by Numbers 27 and verse 21, where Joshua was instructed to inquire, that is, to seek God for unrevealed information, before the priest Eleazar through the Urim and Thummim. Now, this does not indicate that the Urim and Thummim had magical power in themselves, but only that God used these items as a vehicle of his truth. Their use in Israel declined, and there is no instance of their use after the time of David. The robe is what is next described for us. Verse 31 to 32. And thou shalt make the robe of the ephod all of blue. And there shall be an hole in the top of it in the midst thereof. It shall have a binding of woven work round about the whole of it, as it were the whole of an habergeon, that it be not rent. This article of clothing was to be made all of blue, with a hole in the middle of it so that it could be slipped over the head. The edge of this hole was to have a binding so as to prevent it from being torn. In this sense, it was like a habergeon, that is, a short jacket of mail or a coat of mail. And in verses 33 to 35, we read, and beneath upon the hem of it, thou shalt make pomegranates of blue, and of purple, and of scarlet, round about the hem thereof, and bells of gold between them round about, a golden bell and a pomegranate, a golden bell and a pomegranate, upon the hem of the robe round about. And it shall be upon Aaron the minister, and his sound shall be heard when he goeth in into the holy place before the Lord, and when he cometh out, that he die not. On the lower hem is described here the garment. Pomegranates of blue, purple, and scarlet were to be fashioned. Alternating with the pomegranates, we have little golden bells that were to be hung. The number of these items in this instance is not specified. All right, the purpose of the bells was at least for decoration, and it would add to the aura of beauty, glory, and holiness in the eyes of the people. Now, while Aaron was busy in the tabernacle performing the various duties assigned to him, the sound of the bells could be heard. Kill points out that Aaron was not to appear before the Lord without the sound of the bells upon his robe being heard in order that he might not die. In Mark 14, verse 61, where it's recorded the question of Caiaphas, "Art thou the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?" Jesus answered, "I am, and ye shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven." It is then recorded that the high priest rent his clothes, Mark 14:63. Now, this was unlawful and a capital offense on the part of Caiaphas. God has specifically commanded even the sons of Aaron, "Uncover not your heads, neither rend your clothes, lest ye die, and lest wrath come upon all the people," Leviticus 10, verse 6. This rending of his high priestly garments by Caiaphas has been understood as typifying the rending of the priesthood from himself and from the Jewish nation. You see how God is giving us here this grand scheme of redemption. Now, the mitre, the coat, and the girdle. "And thou shalt make a plate of pure gold, engrave upon it," verse 36, "like the engravings of a signet, holiness to the Lord. And thou shalt put it on a blue lace, that it may be upon the mitre. Upon the forefront of the mitre it shall be, and it shall be upon Aaron's forehead, and Aaron may bear the iniquity of the holy things, which the children of Israel shall hallow in all their holy gifts, and it shall be always upon his forehead, that they may be accepted before the Lord." All right, now scholars say the word plate means petal of flower, indicating that the item was in the shape of a flower. The mitre was to be worn on the forehead of the priest. Now, Aaron's bearing the iniquity of the holy things given by the people was a manner of saying that Aaron would bear the iniquity of Israel. This is a symbol of him, Christ, who bore our sins in his own body upon the cross. Verse 39, "And thou shalt embroider the coat of fine linen, and thou shalt make the mitre of fine linen, and thou shalt make the girdle of needlework." Very specific, again, and how they were to go about these things. Now, what about the other priests? Beginning of verse 40, "And for Aaron's sons thou shalt make coats, and thou shalt make for them girdles, and bonnets shalt thou make for them for glory and for beauty. And thou shalt put them upon Aaron thy brother and his sons with him, and shalt anoint them and consecrate them and sanctify them, that they may minister unto me in the priest's office." All right, few details are given here, but more are added later. These garments were to be put on the priest, okay, with Aaron's garments described above being put on him. They were to be anointed, they were to be consecrated, they were to be sanctified. The purpose of all of this was that they might be properly prepared to minister to the Lord. This was not merely for the purpose of show. There were underlying reasons of the meaning. All right, the glory and beauty of the high priest's appearance was typical of the beauty of our high priest, Jesus Christ. The glory and beauty of the other priests was a shadow of the beauty that pertains to Christians. For instance, look at Colossians 3:10-17, and Paul describes the beauty of the Christian there in the light of Christ. Verses 42 and 43, "And thou shalt make them linen breeches to cover their nakedness, from the loins even unto the thighs they shall reach. And they shall be upon Aaron and upon his sons when they come in unto the tabernacle of the congregation, and when they come near unto the altar to minister in the holy place, that they bear not iniquity and die. It shall be a statute forever unto him and his seed after him." Okay, so the priests, all right, were to be provided linen breeches to cover their nakedness. Now, pagan priests and priestesses were noted for their nakedness and obscene behavior as they carried out their evil activities. The religion, though here authorized by God, was designed in such a manner that no essential element of it in any way manifested any similarity whatsoever to the pagan religions of antiquity. And another distinguishing feature of the priesthood here, initiated by Almighty God, was the clothing of its priests in white. contrasting magnificently with the black-robed priests of paganism. This is not always apparent in the scriptures because the word linen, as used here, actually means white linen. Now, Catholicism adopted black robes to distinguish between the clergy and laity, as they called it. Black robes were symbolic of pagan priests. Compare Chemerims and Zephaniah 1 and verse 4. I will also stretch out mine hand upon Judah and upon all the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and I will cut off the remnant of Baal from his place in the name of the Chemerims with the priest. Okay, the priests were to enter the tabernacle, you notice, wearing their priestly garments. This chapter gives a record of the establishment of the Aaronic priesthood, which was later expanded to include others in the tribe of Levi. Now, it was intended to exist only as long as Judaism lasted. It ended with the death of Jesus Christ, Hebrews chapters 8 and 9. You can see also Colossians chapter 2 and Ephesians chapter 2. Friends, God is very, very specific in his plan. And in revealing all of this, he's giving us a shadow of things to come. He's giving us a representation of the church that he intended to establish when Jesus died upon the cross, rose again the third day, and ascended into heaven. We have all of that recorded for us for a reason. God is showing us and unfolding for us his wonderful, excellent scheme of redemption. Friend, we appreciate your time today. We'll get into chapter 29 next week as we begin to look at the consecrating of the priest. We hope you have a great day, a great week. God bless.